peace and social justice and Catholic worker movement and civil rights. And I traveled 3,000 miles to Boston to attend the National Catholic Social Action Convention. And at one of the workshops, one of the Berrigan brothers, I think it was Phil Berrigan, a Jesuit, no, it wasn't a Jesuit, but a priest, he started talking about this Cesar Chavez organizing farm workers in Delano, California. And I almost fell off my chair. I could not believe that Bakersfield, which is only 30 miles from Delano, and that I was considered myself an activist, and I never heard his name, and I did not know he was organizing farm workers 30 miles away. So when I got back to Bakersfield, I tried to call him, but without any success. I couldn't find a listing for him. So I thought maybe I misunderstood. So I got back in touch with Father Berrigan, and he assured me that he was in Delano, he was organizing farm workers, and he thought he had a brother by the name of Richard. So I found Richard Chavez listed in the Delano phone book, and I talked to Richard very briefly, left a message for Cesar to call me. And several days later, Cesar called, and we made an appointment. I went to Delano, and I met him. So it was very roundabout and very unusual, but I was determined to find him, and I did.
And so tell me about this, that first meeting. What did you guys talk about?
Well, I was an educator. I believed in education, and I thought and believed that education was the answer to poverty. The more education you had, the better you would be able to live and at least be able to provide for your children and send them to school, etc. Cesar said no. His priority was not education. His priority was organizing farm workers into a union so they would have stability, so that they would have an opportunity to earn enough money to live on and to raise their children and, in fact, to send them to school. And I thought about my own experience teaching in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco. I taught there for 5 years in the 50s. And I realized, as I thought about it, that most of my students were sons of union members, firefighters, longshore, carpenters, retail clerks, the trades. And then I realized that the reason why these kids were able to go to Sacred Heart High School in San Francisco and pay the tuition, as little as it was at that time, but still, is because their parents had a stable source of income and they were stable in a living situation. Whereas migrant workers are just the opposite. They're constantly moving, constantly striving to find work, have to use their entire family to make enough money to survive. So the kids cannot go to school in any meaningful way. So from my first meeting with Cesar, I learned something that I should have known in the first place.
And you bring an interesting point that you probably have direct experience with, and that we're today, most people I think are removed from. But can you tell us, either through a story or how the best way you could, what was the life for farm workers like then? I don't think people fully understand what life was like for farm workers before there was a union. Paint us a picture or tell us a story.
Well, first of all, what it was like to be raised as a farm worker child. Cesar Chavez himself was raised as a farm worker child. He attended 28 elementary schools before he dropped out. He never went to high school. I don't think he actually finished grade school. So why is that? Why did he have to attend so many schools? The reason is because his family were migrant workers. They had to follow the crops. Wherever the harvests were, they had to be there. They had to be ready to pick. They had to use the entire family in order to make money. They lived in labor camps. If they couldn't get into a labor camp, then they lived in their car. They lived in tents. Many, many migrant workers and farm workers of that era, and still do, live in shacks on the edge of town. Or labor camps that are provided by growers or county housing authorities. But a labor camp is four walls, a concrete floor, and one electrical plug. So one room, your entire family, no air conditioning, no heat. That's your home. Just imagine trying to raise a family in circumstances like that, to try to better yourself and to make progress. Impossible.
And I imagine on top of that, too, there is just, you know, not only is it impossible for us to imagine, I think their immediate employers and must have treated them with such indignity. I imagine they just, what they must have been subjected to in terms of their self-esteem. I mean, what was that like?
Well, farm workers, migrant workers, and self-esteem don't fit in the same sentence. You cannot work harvesting the crops, being paid on a piece rate system, and afford to have any self-esteem. You are a rented slave. You are a workhorse. You are a beast of burden. And if you don't work, you don't get paid. If you have to take a break to go to the bathroom, and bathrooms aren't provided, so if you have to walk into the field to find some privacy where you can relieve yourself, you don't get paid for that. You don't get paid until you return and you're picking the fruit or the grapes or whatever. So self-esteem doesn't help farm workers survive. What helps them survive is this brutalized work system called piece rate.
What was when you first saw that firsthand back in those days when you were working in Bakersfield, what was your emotional response when you came face to face seeing this?
I sponsored a project for an educational project in Bakersfield for migrant worker children one summer. And I recruited teachers from all over California to come for the summer to serve as teachers and tutors for these kids. And as part of the orientation, I assigned the teachers to go work in the fields. In this particular case, it was picking potatoes. And after just an hour or two, maybe they lasted 3 hours, they had to quit. They could not do that physical work, bent over, dragging between their legs a sack of potatoes that ultimately would weigh 25, 30, 35, 50 pounds, and just like a mule. It was incredible. And yet, that was the daily workfare for thousands, thousands of workers in our state. And frankly, still is.
And children, too. I think people don't realize that.
Children had to work. It's all piece rate. If you cannot pick enough potatoes, you cannot make enough money to survive. the dad or the mom working together doesn't pick enough potatoes. Every hand in the household has to be working. Entire families.
Let's pause here to take the slate.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
A little cock for a second.
Sure. It's, yeah, I'm just amazed. I mean, like, it's what is obvious and clear to you, because we're living in California, I think, how we move. Let's change the tone a bit, because we're trying to also humanize Caesar. So tell me a funny story about Caesar, something funny he did, something that sort of reflects his sense of humor that you can think of, especially in light of him doing such serious work.
Well, I'd have to give that some thought.
Sure, we can come back to
it. Yeah, let's come back to it.
Great. Let's see. Here's an important kind of quasi-technical question that we want to establish in the film. And it has to do with the National Labor Relations Act. Tell us, what is the National Labor Relations Act in general, and how does it relate to farmers? I mean, people don't know that they're not covered under some of the basic rights that all other industries are working. So tell me about that act and how it affects farm workers.
The National Labor Relations Act was passed in the mid-30s, probably 1935, and it covered industrial workers. It excluded farm workers, and that was a very important consideration at that time, because the Southern senators would not vote in favor of union rights that would empower the blacks in the South who were farm workers. So the law passed, and farm workers were excluded. They had no rights to a union, no rights to organize, no rights to collective bargaining, no rights to benefits that all other industrial workers were able to gain through unionization. So they were in a class by themselves. And until Cesar Chavez came along and found a way to mobilize them and to organize them. Not that there had not been many, many efforts in California, especially, to organize farm workers. But every one of those efforts was beaten. The union organizers were thrown into jail. They were run out of town. The rent-a-cops would beat up the strikers, would beat up the union organizers. The growers had the power, and they exercised the power. And for 50 years, California agribusiness prevented unionization in the fields. That is, until Cesar Chavez stepped forward.
And, you know, I want the audience to understand your perspective. I mean, you were, at the time you met Cesar Chavez, you were a member of the clergy. I think you were able to see things from a moral perspective, not only like sort of like how you described from the Catholic worker perspective, but they were growers who were Catholics. And if you can give me the sort of the landscape of the sort of religious moral tradition between the growers and how that played out in terms of the relationship and how they treated the farm workers.
Catholicism in the Central Valley of California was on both sides of the aisle. The wealthiest landowners, most of whom were Catholics, most of whom contributed generously to the churches, built the structure of the Roman Catholic Church in the Central Valley. And on the other side were the workers, migrant workers, mostly Mexican-American, mostly Mexican immigrants, who were almost to a family Catholic. So you had this interesting dichotomy. The church officially taught, that workers had rights and had a right to free association and had a right to collective bargaining, had a right to join unions, had a right to better themselves. And on the other hand, you had the growers, also Catholics, who were beating down and had beaten down every effort and would continue to beat down every effort to implement that official teaching of the church. So how do you explain that? Well, I guess money is the answer. Those who had were protecting what they had, and those who didn't have were powerless to do anything about it. Powerless until Cesar Chavez figured out a way to organize them so that they were empowered.
And let's talk about that way and how he did it. If you can walk us through the initial steps of him organizing and how that effort led to essentially to joining the first strike. Walk us through that story.
Cesar Chavez believed that the only way to organize people was what he called community organizing. And that included the entire family. Not just the head of the household, not just the prime worker of the family, but everyone in the family. So he devised a system, a way of organizing in the living room and the kitchens of people, where they lived, in the ghettos where they lived. And he called them, and they were house meetings. So meetings of neighbors. So people would come together, 6, 8, 10, and sit around with Cesar Chavez, and he would explain his vision of having a union for farm workers and what they could accomplish and why it was important and how they had to stick together and how difficult it was going to be and the rights that they should have but don't have. And little by little, person by person, little by little, person by person, he built the National Farm Workers Association. And the people who joined paid dues, $3.50 a month, as I remember it, and that included a death benefit of $500 for burial if a family member died, which was very important to Mexican-American people and Mexican people, immigrants. Having a proper burial was very important. It was a cultural and religious tradition. And there were case after case where people would die and in the family, and they would have to go out and literally beg neighbors and friends for money so that they could have a proper burial. Well, by having a death benefit program that was paid as part of your monthly dues, this was a great relief to farm workers. And now, maybe it doesn't sound like much, but in the 1960s, with poverty at that level, it was a very, very important benefit that they paid for themselves.
And then how did things grow from this providing these critical services? Here's a fundamental question. How was Cesar initially received by families that he approached? Were they just ready to jump on board?
The first 9 months, the first 8 months of Caesar's effort to organize his National Farm Workers Association, he almost starved to death. He ran into a lot of disbelief among workers themselves. Why are you doing this? Who's paying you? Well, I'm not being paid. Well, if you're not being paid, what's that all about? Are you for real, or, you know, what's happening? And Caesar had no money. He would have to organize his day so that he was around during the dinner hour so that he would be invited to join the family so he could eat for the day. I mean, Cesar Chavez was a very dedicated person. And little by little, person by person, we're not talking huge numbers here. You don't need huge numbers to create change. You need dedicated, committed people. And that's who Cesar Chavez was looking for. He was looking for the natural leaders in the communities, in the state of California, in the farm worker community. And he found them. And they pledged their support, and they stuck with him, and they believed in his vision. It was only a dream at that point. Caesar had no idea when there would be a strike, or even if there would be a strike. I think he would have preferred 5-10 years of community organizing before he felt comfortable in a strike. Well, it didn't turn out that way. He started his association in 1962, and in the harvest of 1965, the Filipino workers went out on strike in Delano in the grapes. And a week later, the Cesar Chavez and his National Farm Workers Association voted to chime in and join the picket lines.
And we just ran out of picket We didn't get quite the end of that.
We'll come back to that.
So reload.
I'm still learning to work within these 12.
And we should pick up that last 20 seconds there. Yeah.
So Leroy, tell me how this community organizing that Cesar Chavez started, how did that lead to a strike?
Cesar Chavez had planned in his own mind, I think, that he would take maybe 5 years, maybe up to 10 years of community organizing before he felt comfortable having a base of support that if a strike happened, that they would be able to win the strike or at least have an opportunity to win the strike. But it didn't turn out that way because after just a few years, he founded the association in 1962, and in the harvest of 1965 in Delano, the Filipino workers walked out on strike for higher wages. And a week later, it put so much pressure on the National Farm Workers Association to join or not to join. They voted to join and to go out on strike. But Caesar used that and seized that opportunity not only to go out on strike, but they were going to stay out on strike forever if that's what it required. There was going to be no wildcat strike where the grower would come along and offer another nickel per grape box as part of the piece rate system. None of that. They were going out on strike, and they would not come off until they had a union contract with the employer. They had a right to collective bargaining, and they were going to exercise that right.
So it really was almost like this joining of forces, if you will, between the Filipino farm workers and Caesar's largely Mexican-American farm workers, and also a mutual respect not to undermine, in this case, the Filipinos' strike. Was that sort of
There were two organizations in Delano in the harvest summer of 1965, the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, AFL-CIO, which was organizing under the direction of Lariat Leong, a Filipino farm worker, and a paid employee of the AFL-CIO. And he was the leader of the Filipino workers in that area at that time. And they went out on strike. He called a strike. The piece rate was abysmally low, and it was unfair. The Filipinos did not want to work, and no one could blame them. So they went out on strike. The other organization was the NFWA, National Farm Workers Association, that was organized by Cesar Chavez. And their commitment was for collective bargaining, the right to a union, the right to sit down across the table from the employer and hammer out a union contract. So those two forces came together. They came together in a parallel fashion, and they came to each other's mutual assistance. For example, the Filipinos in Delano had what they called a community hall. It's called Filipino Hall, complete with a full kitchen. And so that became the strike kitchen for everyone. Everyone, whether it was the NFWA or the members of AWOC who were on strike, ate their main meal every day at Filipino Hall. We also had the Friday night meetings at Filipino Hall, the union meetings. And both sides were, as I say, parallel, but working hand in glove with one another, trying for the first time ever to bring about unionization in California agribusiness.
So the strike breaks out. Right, and that must be a hugely risky maneuver for farm workers who are living hand to mouth, and all of a sudden there's no income. Walk me through once the strike breaks out, what happens next? They just walk out and hope for the best?
It's very difficult to imagine how brave and courageous a farm worker can be when he or she has to make the decision, if I leave my job, I have no source of income. My only opportunity this year to earn money is during this harvest season. And I'm walking away from that opportunity because I believe we should be treated more justly. I believe we should have a right to our own union and to have some say about what we're paid and our working conditions. Well, when they walk out of the field, they have to rely on the union for survival. So the union, who has no money in the treasury, they have to beg, borrow, and steal donations from around the state, from church groups, from union groups, from student groups. So within days after the strike broke out, food caravans were coming to Delano with foodstuffs to help support those families that went out on strike. And they also raised money, and they brought money. It went to the treasury of the union, and that money in turn was used to pay the most basic bills, like a mortgage payment or a car payment, to keep people afloat. Now, how long could the union keep people afloat in a situation like that? Not very long. But poor people are survivors. Poor people know how to make a donation of food or a donation of clothing or a donation of money go a long, long way. They're very frugal. They're very, very clever. And they help one another. It's not every person for themselves. It's brother helping sister, brother helping brother, parents helping children and the reverse. So, but when you lose your home that you've been paying on, or you lose your car, or you can't get your car fixed because you don't have any money because you're out on strike, those are difficult times for people. And yet they stood up. They wouldn't take no for an answer. And they just continued to follow Cesar Chavez, and he just led them one step at a time until ultimately they prevailed. Ultimately they prevailed.
Let's pause here to reload for a second.
Push reload cards.
There's a resilience and a resourcefulness. And what's great is Jim comes from that training from the film days. I imagine it must have been very difficult once the strike broke out to actually convince farmers to walk out, because I saw there's this great footage of very young Caesar is at the side of a field, and it's Caesar and it's Dolores and it's Luis Valdez. They're at the side of the field and trying to inspire people to come out. Tell me about the difficulty or the resistance they actually had or to get these people to walk away from those fields.
Convincing farm workers who are harvesting, remember, this is their only time of the year to make money, to leave their job and walk out and join the union, and leave the area and go work somewhere else. It's very difficult. It'd be very difficult for you, very difficult for me. And especially if they were bussed in by the growers, maybe from an hour away, maybe 2 hours away. So they're from the outside. They're brought here to work. They weren't told that they were breaking a strike. They're here. They're being used to break the strike. Well, what are they going to do? I mean, if they walk out of the field and join the union, how do they get home, for example? If they stay, then they're strike breakers, and certainly many of them do not want to be used as strike breakers. So maybe they won't come back tomorrow, but today they're sort of stuck. And it is a dilemma for them. And I think it's amazing, really, how the Delano grape strikers standing on the edge of the field were able to convince a few, and then dozens, and then many dozens, but not just on one day, day after day after day, because new workers were being brought in to break the strike. They had to start all over again, so to speak. Every day was a new day. And it's amazing, really. And it shows you how dedicated and how committed that these farm workers were, who wanted a union and wanted to better their lives and the lives of their children, and even better the lives of the strike breakers, if they could only realize it. So... it's hard work.
It also says something to the charisma of Cesar Chavez to first inspire that initial core and then have the sort of, you know, the rings grow. I mean, this must have been a phenomenally, I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but clearly to fill the waves, he had to have been a charismatic figure, like perhaps like you'd never met before.
You can live several lifetimes and never meet a person like Cesar Chavez. I feel extremely fortunate to be living just one lifetime and not only have the opportunity to meet him, but to work with him and to learn from him. And why was Cesar Chavez so charismatic? First of all, He was authentic. People are looking for someone that is authentic to lead them. He practiced what he preached. He didn't say one thing and then lived another way. Cesar Chavez lived a life of voluntary poverty for the sake of others, so that he could be free to do nothing else but to try to help others. Now, what would your response be if your leader was not enriching himself at your expense, but was suffering, so to speak, willing to give up possessions, willing to give up money, willing to give up his family if necessary, to try to better your situation? It would elicit a response, a positive response generally, and it did. Everyone who came in contact with Cesar Chavez felt that he was there for them, and he was only there for them. He was not there for himself. Now, that is charisma. That is what attracts people, and people came from all over the United States as to be volunteers as part of this movement, to say nothing of the farm workers who actually came out, gave up their jobs to go on strike, to man the picket lines. So they were volunteers. The strikers were volunteers. The students who came from around the country, they were volunteers. I was a volunteer. Cesar Chavez attracted people because he was authentic.
So, and back to the strike then, you hit on something earlier, and that is, and has to go with, how do the growers respond? They bring in strike breakers who they don't tell are strike breakers, but tell us, how do they respond to the strike and to this charismatic man?
The growers' response is somewhat typical, somewhat understandable. When they're confronted with their workers going out on strike, like the Filipinos, for example, many of the growers said, "My boys, they don't want a union. I know my boys. They're not going to follow Cesar Chavez. My boys are well paid. I take care of my boys." That very paternalistic approach to your workers. I own these people. These are my people. In effect, these workers do not have a life of their own, separate and apart from working in my fields. I mean, I am their source of income. And the reality is, the employer, in this case, the grape growers, they had the power, they had the money, they had the jobs. So, they're not going to be pushed around. They're not going to stand still for some guy by the name of Cesar Chavez who comes along and says this or says that or is going to do this or do that. No way. And if you don't want to work here, you want to go on strike, go on strike. There's 100 more workers from where you came from. And there are. They imported into Delano area. I saw the buses myself coming in from the Mexican border, bus after bus after bus, bringing workers to work in the fields as strike breakers. Did these workers know they were going to be used as strike breakers? Of course not. Did the grower care whether they were going to be used as strike breakers? Of course not.
Let's pause here and for a reset. You bring up an interesting point, and that is the busloads that you saw. And it's created some confusion and some not fully understanding the nuance. And that is that for at one point, the farm worker movement, the UFW, or I don't know if they were UFW at the time, they had to make an important decision about a position on immigration. The importation of these workers, and I think it often gets confused with a anti-immigration position at that time. Can you clarify that for us?
Cesar Chavez told me once that if his mother crossed the picket line, he would oppose her. That is how strongly he felt about anyone who would work as a strikebreaker. Even his own mother, he said. So, workers that were brought in from the outside, especially the Mexican border, first of all, had no idea that they were going to be used as strikebreakers. But then when they got there and were being used as strikebreakers, they had to make a decision, and Cesar Chavez expected them to leave the work and not to break the strike. And to the extent that he would not do that, they would not do that, he was opposed to them. Now, he was not opposed to immigration. He's not opposed to... he's opposed to strikebreakers. These people on the picket lines have sacrificed everything for the sake of trying to better their lives. And it is not right, whether they're brought by the employers or brought by someone else, to come and take the bread out of other people's mouths. So it was never, ever an immigration issue. It's a strike-breaking issue. And whether you're red, white, blue, or green, if you cross the picket line, you were on the wrong side.
Tell me how this strike, did it escalate? Did it get more tense, either just the duration of them wearing you down or the introduction of violence and intimidation? I imagine it must have escalated at some point. When and how did it escalate?
It didn't take most of us very long to realize that you could not win a strike in Delano from the picket line. You have to remember the strike area for the Delano grape strike extended from Arvin and Lamont, which is south of Bakersfield, to Ducor, which is upper Tulare County. So we're talking about 65, 70 miles long. This is the strike area and probably average 7 or 8 miles wide. Now, you have a small handful of strikers who are trying to bring about social justice for themselves and for others. How could they possibly prevail in an arena that large with over 30 growers, the most powerful landowners in California, agribusiness, the largest industry in California? How could they prevail? They wouldn't be able to. So now what? What do you do?
So this is very good. What do you do? And they're very wise. And Cesar decides to target one grower. Tell me about the targeting of that grower, so we can get a sense and a personification of at least one component of the opposition.